trip. Head for the moon at a rocket clip. We're gonna zoom, zoom, rocket. Zoom a little, zoom, now we're almost free from the Earth's gravity. Zooming to the moon at terrific speed, because there is no friction. Soon we'll see if the moon is made out of green cheese. Ha, 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 ha. Zoom, we're here at the moon. Let's see what the moon is like.
Hello and welcome to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. On today's show, we're going to dip back into some material and interviews that we weren't able to cover during the funding drive. And by the way, thanks to everyone for their fantastic support of the station during our funding drive at the beginning of the month, rather the end of last month. So some of the topics that we got into during the funding drive show, along with Julia, who joined us on the telephone, was a lot about science literacy and science education. And Julia and I kind of got up on our soapboxes and let it go about why we thought science literacy and education was so important. But we had a few interviews lined up that we didn't manage to get to during that show, and we're going to return to those today. In particular, we'll be hearing from Erica Eliasson of UBC's Let's Talk Science, and also Carl Wyman, the latest Nobel Prize-winning addition to UBC's faculty. And of course, we, wherever possible, we'll try to pepper this with some fun news, perhaps a holiday gift idea or two, and some music. Now, while we're got your attention and kicking the show off, if you ever want to get in touch with us, please feel free to drop us an email at myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca. So do get in touch, share your thoughts, your suggestions, your topics of interest at myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca.
Thank you.
listening to My Science Project in Vancouver, and I'm your host, Anne, the Vancouver host of this show. And today we're having a little bit of a look at some of the issues we didn't cover in a previous show where Julia joined me. And what we do want to cover in this show are sort of some of the new trends that we're seeing in science education and science literacy. And certainly one of those involves the presence of science in the community. And previously, if you think about it, science has been fairly exclusive, and it's been fairly exclusive to the academic setting. You'll find it in schools and universities. Some of our bigger cities may be lucky enough to house a science center. Some schools may be a bit more heavily involved in the science fair. But altogether, science has been fairly reserved and exclusive domain. But what we're seeing now is more and more that science education and communication is expanding beyond this mold. For example, science is moving into the community in the form of community discussion groups. And you've probably heard a lot about Café Scientifique, something that Julia and I have been involved in, which is a community discussion forum for science and technology. You're also seeing it more and more in some of our cultural indulgences, such as films. A good example of that recently is An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's film that had a look at the issues of climate change and global warming. So what we're seeing more and more is that science is becoming a culture, and science has a place in culture, and a lot of people are deriving pleasure from scientific activities outside of school and the workplace. And another thing that has to be said is that we're seeing an increase in novel partnerships, such as between the university and community groups. And one really fantastic example of that is UBC's Let's Talk Science program. And this is a program that partners UBC graduate students with primary and secondary school teachers in the community to provide support and hands-on experiments in the classroom. I had the opportunity about a month ago now to speak with Erica Eliasson, who is one of the leaders of Let's Talk Science program. And we had a nice chat and covered quite a lot of the basic questions about what Let's Talk Science is and what it offers to the student.
Talk Science Partnership Program
queuing that up. You can hear her now.
1993, by a woman by the name of Bonnie Schmidt at the University of Western Ontario. And what she wanted was just to her and a bunch of her grad student friends thought, you know, we should do some community outreach. So they just went out and started, you know, visiting classrooms out in the community, doing hands-on science activities with the kids to excite them about science. And that's kind of how the program was born. Here at UBC, we've been going since 1996, so we just had our 10-year anniversary.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And at the base of the program is just that. We do hands-on science activities with classrooms. Our program is primarily made up of graduate students, but we also have some undergraduate volunteers as well. And in addition to these hands-on classroom visits, we also do a whole bunch of community events. So these are things like judging science fairs, doing events at the UBC bookstore. The kids from grad students will come to the UBC bookstore and we'll do some hands-on activities with them to promote a book maybe. We've done just a plethora of things. We do rural visits now out into rural communities like Prince George, Houston, Osoyoos and Oliver, places like that. A whole bunch of other things.
So what's it like when you go into a classroom? How long do you spend and what do you do?
Well, typically it depends on the age of the students. If you're going to kindergarten class, you probably can't hold their attention as long, so you might only go for 45 minutes or an hour, and then typically up to an hour and a half or even 2 hours visits. And really the sky is the limit for visits, whatever you want to do. We really promote hands-on activities or demonstrations because that's really the best way that I think for kids to learn and get excited about science. We're trying to convey that science isn't what you memorize from a textbook. It's not just something that everything's been figured out and you just read in a book and that's all there is. We want people to realize that science is about discovery and having fun and really getting messy and dirty and getting right in there and learning things for yourself. So, for example, for like a grade 6-7 class, I might go in and do an activity on bacteria and health. And we might give the kids all a plate of agar and then get them to go swab, you know, sinks or toilets or door handles, tables, all that kind of stuff. And we can grow the bacteria. And then what we also do is we have GloGerm. They use it sometimes in health stuff or safety demonstrations here at UBC.
For showing you how to wash your hands.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we do that actually to teach the kids how to pass on germs. So we'll give one person will have a whole bunch of that ink on their hands, and then you shake hands with the other kids, and they realize how the germs get passed. And then they go and wash their hands and realize how incredibly dirty they are. Now they're not very good at washing their hands. So
sounds fun. How do you go about developing programs with teachers, and in what way do teachers get involved in what you do?
Well, actually, it's really great for teachers because, especially in elementary school, a lot of teachers don't have a strong science background. They might have majored in English or social studies or something along those lines, and so they don't really know how to teach electricity to grade 4 students. And so we get some panicked emails sometimes from teachers saying, please help, I need help, you know, come to my classroom and teach me about science. And so that's the number one reason that a lot of teachers get involved. Mostly teachers just sign up online and say, I want to have a grad student come into my classroom. And then sometimes you'll develop the activity with the teacher, either in conjunction with what's in the curriculum, or often teachers just want someone to come in and excite the kids about science. They don't care what it is. As long as it's, you know, something fun and it's interesting, then bring it on.
Do the kids get excited?
Oh, yeah. The kids love it. They just, I mean, especially since one of the best things about our program is that we do repeat visits. So often you're paired with a teacher for the entire school year. So you go in the first time, introduce yourself, maybe dispel some myths about stereotypes about scientists and things, and then maybe do one activity. But they just get so excited for the next visits because, you know, they had so much fun the first time around. They really get to know you and you build that bond with them. Yeah, they respond very well.
Along the lines of stereotypes, this is kind of a silly question, but I was wondering if you wear a lab coat.
Never. Well, I think if I was doing a chemistry demo and it was really toxic, I might wear a lab coat. We do try to promote safety ideas, but no, one of my first things I often do when I go into a classroom is, you know, ask them to describe the typical scientist, and I'll draw on the blackboard, you know, the crazy big hair, those big glasses, you know, test tubes bubbling and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, I'll explain that I'm a scientist. You know, I'm young, I'm a woman, I play sports, I have friends, and all that kind of stuff. And they really are taken aback by that often.
Amazing. Another thing that I wondered about is what makes grad students who are part of this program, what makes them particularly good at what they're doing, and what sort of special abilities do grad students bring into the classroom?
Well, I think a lot of things. First, grad students actually make science real because you're actually meeting a scientist. It's, you know, it's one thing to read a textbook and you can't really visualize it, I think, as a student. And then meeting a real scientist and realizing how they do things is really, really exciting. You're actually bringing cutting-edge research to these kids and you're being a great role model. There's a lot of students who may not be very good at science in the classroom as in the typical memorizing from a textbook sense, but they really have an aptitude for hands-on activities and for discovering things. And so maybe they would be really great scientists. So I think really as a role model and really bringing a real science knowledge base to the classroom is great.
Along those lines, I wondered if you can identify kids who have a special ability at science at such a young age, if there's something that ever stands out.
I think often the questions. It's amazing. Honestly, I can go to a grade 3 class and I'm guaranteed to get stumped by something the kids are going to ask. And I think that's not necessarily the kid who knows all the right answers, but it's the one who asks the right questions or the off-the-wall questions that I never even thought about before. Like just two weeks ago, I was in a grade 9 classroom and we're doing an activity with dry ice and pH indicators and how you put dry ice in, it forms an acid and the pH indicator changes color. And one of the students asked me what pH is, like what it stands for. And like the letters, I have no idea, and the teacher didn't know, and the other chemistry teacher didn't know, and it was just really funny because you really realize how much you don't know. And I think that's probably the best I can think of.
I can imagine it also reminds you about what you do know and sort of can give you a good confidence boost as a grad student maybe going through a bit of a rut or something.
Oh my goodness, yes. I mean, you can be just not feeling so good and your research isn't going great and, you know, no one's ever going to read your thesis and you're just totally bummed out. But you go into a classroom and your enthusiasm rubs off on the kids. The kids' enthusiasm rubs off on you and you just both just get so excited about what you're doing. And I think it really helps grad students think globally again, because one of the biggest problems with grad school in my mind is that you're so focused on this one little bitty problem and all the challenges that go with grad school, and you just kind of don't see how you fit in the big picture. And going out to the classroom, you're relearning things that you forgot. Like, I don't remember anything about circuits, to be honest. You know, series, parallel, I don't remember. I have to go reteach myself that before I go into grade 4 class in order to connect the activity. And then I'm also realize how much I do remember and how much I do know in the first place.
You're listening to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM, and that was Erica Eliasson of UBC's Let's Talk Science program. We'll be returning to that interview and its extension in just a moment, but right now this is Buck 65 and a funky little tune called Bachelor of Science.
Nice and take care of my appearances, keep out of trouble and trifle interferences. The Bachelor of Science, I run my own company. Somebody call me, my number's unlisted. Some stories are straight and others come twisted. Women's intuition and young gals' luck. Every girl I know has a crush on. Boys may cheat, either that or they might leave her. All I wanna do is dance, I've got Saturday night fever. So let me rearrange my sock drawers alone behind locked doors and make scrambled eggs for breakfast and sit and read the box scores. But I'm not trying to score points with. I'd rather read the Bible than use its pages to roll joints with. I get what I want, but got no one to share it with. A feeling in my chest and nothing to compare it with. The Bachelor of Science, I run my own company.
Thanks for listening today to My Science Project, and that's Buck 65 with a bit of Bachelor of Science. We've been listening today to a couple of interviews. Well, one interview so far with Erica Eliasson of UBC's Let's Talk Science program that partners UBC graduate students with teachers in primary and secondary schools. We're going to get back to that in just a moment, but for now, I just want to play for you a quick PSA.
Right to Play is an international humanitarian organization using sport and play programs to encourage the healthy physical, social, and emotional development of the world's most disadvantaged children. RTP at UBC is run by a team of committed university students who advocate sport for development, and it is the first university chapter of its kind. We want you to get involved. Together, we can educate students about sport for development, help raise money, and teach children here in the Lower Mainland about the importance of sport and a healthy lifestyle. So check us out at www.interchange.ubc.ca/RTPUBC.
This is My Science Project on CITR, and in just a moment we're going to get back to an interview with Erica Eliasson of Let's Talk Science. And shortly coming up on the program, we'll be hearing an excerpt from Carl Wieman's speech, which was delivered at the annual general meeting. So here I'm just queuing up again the second component of the second installment of my interview with Erica Eliasson, and hopefully you're enjoying that. Here it is now.
Downtown East Side. One is the SMART program, one is mentorship, and the other one is we help out with Reading Week. So those three are, we're partnered with a learning exchange here on campus, and what that is all about is really going to the inner city where a lot of these kids don't have the same opportunities as kids out here. For example, I'll talk about mentorship. I've judged many, many, many science fairs, and you can always tell when there's that kid whose mom or dad is a professor and they're out curing cancer, and you know they're going to the regional science fair, they're going to go to Canada-wide and get a great prize. But then there's that kid in the downtown East Side who maybe is living in a foster home or is a single parent and just doesn't have the same money or opportunities to excel in things like science fairs. So what we've done is we paired with Britannia Secondary School, which has a large Aboriginal community as well as just highly at-risk students. And we're going to be mentoring 60 of their kids for their science fair projects, which is just a great opportunity for those kids to suddenly be able to be exposed to UBC students, exposed to being able to do things like replicate, and learn about randomization, and have someone there to really help and guide them, as well as give them just the tools that they need to conduct a good science fair project. So
that's something that's going to contribute to scientific literacy in a broad range of people. Why do you see scientific literacy as something that's important and valuable?
Well, gosh, where to start? Scientific literacy is obviously incredibly important, and we're very passionate about that at Let's Talk Science. And a lot of our volunteers, when they say they want to sign up for the program, is essentially because of that. They want to convey scientific literacy to just everybody. I think a lot of kids in elementary school or high school think, well, I don't want to be a scientist, so it doesn't matter to me. I don't care about chemistry. I'm not going to be a chemist wanting to learn this. And they don't realize, and so things like the scientific method especially, and they don't realize that science is really about questioning things and forming your own opinions and discovering the world and being able to understand the world around you. And how can you really make a judgment about climate change if you don't understand climate change or if you don't have the tools to be able to learn more about climate change? So I think that science is everywhere. Science really affects us. And what we can do is make it more accessible to the people and make more people want to learn about it and to understand how it affects them.
When I think about how I learned science when I was 8 and 10 and 12 years old, it had a lot to do with demonstrations, you know, like that erupting volcano with baking soda and vinegar or whatever goes mm-hmm. into it, or, you know, watching a crystal grow. Lots of demonstrations and not a lot of asking questions and testing hypotheses. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you're able to encourage people to be more experimenters than demonstrators and how you do that.
Definitely. I think so. I think, first of all, we can really help teachers in that area because we can help give them examples of an experiment that you can take through with the kids to learn about the scientific method. So, for example, what I'll do is I can guide the kids through an experiment. So I won't tell them what the outcome's going to be, but every single student is going to do an experiment and then learn for themselves and form their own hypotheses. So one thing I did was I mentioned dry ice. So if you put dry ice in a pH indicator, the CO2 will combine with the water to form an acid. So I do that demonstration for the kids, and they all see what happens. They all understand, okay, CO2 plus water makes an acid. So now I think, well, where else is there CO2? You know, and then eventually some kids are going to brainstorm, well, we breathe out CO2. Like, okay, great. So what do you think would happen if we blew CO2 into a pH indicator? And so I give every single kid their own little vial and their own straw, and then they can write their observations, and we really take them through all the steps from the knowledge first and making some observations to forming your hypotheses to testing your hypotheses. We even replicate because every kid in the class is doing it. So then we can write up all the observations on the board and then come up with conclusions. So there are definitely ways to guide kids through the experimental method in a more hands-on approach.
So you sort of start with a demonstration and a principle of science and mm-hmm. then ask questions that might apply it.
Exactly, and have the kids think about how they can keep on going. Okay, we know piece of information A, so how can we get to something else? Like, where does that take us? What other question can we ask from that?
So yeah, I think that's the important step.
Yeah, really, that's asking questions and then trying to figure out a good, sound way to test those. Yeah.
Before we wrap up today, I wonder if you can think off the top of your head from your repertoire of activities of something that the average listener might be able to do at home.
Oh, well, definitely. How about Mentos and pop?
I've heard about that one.
You've heard about that one?
I need the recipe.
Okay, good. So I actually do this on Saturday nights with my friends. And I'm not kidding.
The truth comes out.
All you need to do is get a 2-liter of pop, whichever brand you want, but I use Diet Coke because it's not as sticky, and then get a whole roll of Mentos. And the key is you got to try to get the whole roll in there as much as you can, so make a funnel out of a piece of paper or something like that, and then just direct it towards the can of pop or the bottle of pop, and watch what happens.
What can we expect, or what should we be prepared for?
You should be prepared to be outside, and what happens is that it's actually the Mentos has, you know how Mentos feel smooth? Mm-hmm. It's actually not. There's tons of little, tiny little microscopic pores on it, and they form their nucleating sites for the carbon dioxide within the pop, and so the carbon dioxide will come out of solution and cause this huge explosion.
Particle man, doing the things a particle can. What's he like? It's not important. Particle man, is he a dot or is he a speck? When he's underwater, does he get wet? Or does the water get him instead? Nobody knows. Particle man. Triangle man, triangle man. Triangle man hates particle man. They have a fight. Triangle wins. Triangle man. Universe man, universe man. Size of the entire universe man, usually kind to smaller man, universe man. He's got a watch with a minute hand, millennium hand, energy on hand. And when they meet, it's a happy land, powerful man, universe man. Person man, hit on the head with a frying pan, lives his life in a garbage can. Person man, is he depressed or is he a mess? Does he feel totally worthless? Who came up with person man? Degraded man, person man. Triangle man, triangle man hates person man. They have a fight, triangle wins, triangle man.
Well, that was They Might Be Giants and Particle Man, and, well, frankly, that was a bit of a silly way to introduce a rather remarkable man. And who I'm introducing now is Dr. Carl Wieman. He is a recent addition to the University of British Columbia Physics faculty, and he's been brought in to head a well-endowed science education program here. And that education initiative comes together in a center for the study and promotion of science education called the Carl Wieman Science Education Initiative, or CWSEI. And it's of particular note that Carl Wieman should be joining UBC, and it certainly created a bit of a buzz because Dr. Wieman is famous for having won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2001. He's currently famous for his dedication to science education, but certainly it's his role in earning the Nobel Prize in 2001 that's creating the buzz. In fact, Carl Wieman makes Canada home to two Nobel Prize winners in the university sector, and the other being John Pugliani at University of Toronto. Carl Wieman, yes, he won the Nobel Prize in 2001, and he shared it along with Eric Cornell and Wolfgang Kederl, Wolfgang Kederl being from MIT, and Eric Cornell and Carl Wieman at the time at University of Colorado at Boulder. And they won this award for achieving the Bose-Einstein condensate and study of that phase of matter. And a condensate is actually extremely low temperature fluids, and the temperature is so low that it's very, very near, as near as possible to absolute zero, which happens to be zero kelvins or minus 273.15 degrees Celsius. And it's at this extremely low temperature that quantum effects become apparent on a macroscopic scale. So actually, this state of matter was first predicted as a consequence of quantum mechanics by Albert Einstein. And this has also included knowledge of the work of Satyendra Nath Bose in 1925. So building on that, in 1995, Eric Cornell, Carl Wieman, and Wolfgang Kederl studied and demonstrated this phase of matter. And it's an extremely significant step in the study of physics. But like I said, Carl Wieman comes to UBC more to be involved in science education. And in a sense, this is what's really novel about science education here at UBC, is that these new programs are being developed and a new approach to science education. And for lack of a better word, it's sort of the scientification of science. So what I really mean by that is that Carl Wieman and will be leading a team who will use actually the scientific method to study and improve science education. And it's going to depend rather heavily on their ability to quickly learn about what works in science education and translate that rapidly into the classroom setting. And it's been stated that Dr. Wyman favors a pedagogical system developed by one Eric Mazur. And this system is known as peer instruction. It sounds quite a lot of fun to me, although I've never had the chance to try it out. And in this system, teachers repeatedly ask multiple choice concept questions during class, and students reply on the spot with a little wireless clicker device. And the idea is that if a large proportion of the class chooses the wrong answer, students then discuss amongst themselves and can reply again. It kind of reminds me a bit of a game show where you have the ask the audience question option in order to help you answer questions. But it sounds like this has been a well-established way to teach science in the classroom. And Carl Wyman was invited to speak recently at the UBC annual general meeting. And it was during this speech that he succinctly outlined his strategy for improving science education at UBC. And he also does this with a nice reference and metaphor using airplanes. So have a listen to that.
This is a time for great need and great opportunities in post-secondary education. The first need is to develop a public that has the technical literacy required to make wise decisions about these critical global scale issues that mankind faces today, such as global warming, pollution, genetic modification, etc. The second great need is to provide all of our students with the technical know-how and complex problem-solving skills that will allow them to be successful in the modern high-tech economy, regardless of what occupation they pursue. Also, as a society, we need a workforce with these skills to allow our economy to thrive. Now, meeting these needs is an enormous and quite unprecedented educational challenge. Fortunately, great opportunities to improve education have arisen in the form of recent advances in research on learning and advances in educational technology. I believe that at UBC, we can seize these opportunities and meet this great educational challenge we face. We'll be able to demonstrate to the world how to provide an exceptional undergraduate education for all students at a major research university. Now, these advances in research on learning have provided us with guiding principles and clear demonstrations of how it's possible to achieve a science education for all university students that's far more engaging and useful than the traditional approaches. And this is true both for those students who are intending to be scientists or engineers and those who may only take one or two science courses in their college career. The research has also shown us better ways to measure student thinking and learning. Advances in information technology have given us powerful new ways to present material, as well as methods to enhance an instructor's capabilities so that they can provide the effective assessment, guidance, and education for large numbers of students. Now, while important, all of these advances are only the first half of what is needed. These advances have provided us with rigorously tested principles for effective learning and successful prototypes for how to use them in college teaching. However, higher education does not yet have the needed research-based and tested instructional methods, assessments, and technology available for use in all science courses. And most faculty are not yet sufficiently well-versed in these research advances to take advantage of such materials. The situation is rather like flying was in the early part of the last century, shortly after the first airplanes had been demonstrated. I mean, this was an enormous breakthrough. It showed that humans could fly. But there was still a lot of work required to go from those prototype airplanes to the system of air travel we have now, where anyone can quickly and easily be whisked to anywhere in the world. At least it's quick and easy once you finally get through the security screening. So what we need in education is the educational engineering and development, if you like, required so that these advances in learning research and the supporting technology are being used in every college classroom to improve both educational effectiveness and efficiency. And this is the work that the Science Education Initiative at UBC will support. Now, I decided to move to UBC because it seemed to me to be the university where this work could be the most successful. And what convinced me of this are the many excellent faculty at UBC who are exceptionally committed to undergraduate education and are already pursuing many innovations in science education here. I was also attracted by the bold, forward-looking administration that has a similar commitment to education. The focus of the Science Education Initiative will be to work with these faculty and support their innovative efforts. In this way, we can accelerate the development and implementation process so that an outstanding educational experience built on these research-based educational practices can become the norm in UBC classrooms as quickly as possible. This work will initially focus on the sciences, but will be extended to all subjects at the university as rapidly as is practical. Now, it has to be recognized, though, that as attractive as this idea appears, it's nevertheless a bold experiment with many challenges. We ultimately want nothing less than to determine how well every student is achieving the knowledge, skills, and ways of thinking that make up a high-quality education, and then use that information to continuously improve instructional practices and correspondingly student learning. Now, approaching post-secondary education in such a scientific fashion is quite unprecedented, and to accomplish it will require reducing the time scale for major changes in universities from the usual decades or even centuries down to a few years, and will require a major investment. I mean, the fact that chalk and the blackboard is still the technology of choice in the majority of college classrooms provides a sobering reminder of the scale of the challenge we face. It is clear, though, that the academic world is watching this experiment at UBC with great anticipation. Since it was announced, I've been overwhelmed with requests to talk about it at universities around the world, and I'm being contacted by many faculty members and deans from all over North America who want to come spend time here participating in this program and learning from what we're doing here. A lot of these folks may have second thoughts when they actually see what the housing prices are in Vancouver, but in any case, this is a striking indication of how this initiative has caught the attention of the higher education community. They're looking at UBC in the hopeful expectation that this will provide them with a model for transforming their own colleges and universities. Now, the commitment of many excellent, innovative faculty and administrators are essential to this effort, and as I said before, what attracted me to UBC. However, these alone aren't sufficient. There's one missing ingredient that I believe is necessary for this initiative to achieve its full potential. That ingredient is the support of the communities and industries who will benefit most directly from this improved science education and the more capable workforce and the wiser, technically literate citizens it'll produce. It may sound a bit tactless, but such support is really the only truly convincing way of demonstrating that they value such an education. And without that demonstration, it will be difficult to convince all faculty of the importance of this initiative and its goals and thus be completely successful. Now, as our own personal demonstration of the importance that my wife and I feel improved education holds for the future of society and the potential of this initiative at UBC, we're contributing $50,000 to support it. I hope that there are many other citizens and companies in British Columbia who feel the same way. Let me close by repeating how delighted we are to be moving to the wonderful city of Vancouver and joining the exciting effort at UBC to create the model for post-secondary education for the 21st century. Thank you.
That was Carl Wieman speaking recently at UBC annual general meeting. And I think he raises a few very interesting points, and very, very correct points. In particular, I think he points out that our use of technology in the classroom is really, really lagging behind our capabilities and our options of technological educational tools. And he even commented to say that you know, chalk and the chalkboard seems to be the going means of communication and the key tool in the classroom, which is shocking considering what we all know computers are capable of and all kinds of media options that are available to us. But at the same time, he is very optimistic, and he sort of compares where we're at with scientific education to where we were at the turn of the century with flight. And we certainly have the ability to do fabulous things in education. And I think it is with Carl Wieman's initiative for science education that hopefully we'll see some of those things come into application very quickly. Now, I've got one little bit of news to get to that I think you're really going to enjoy. But before I do that, I just have a quick roundup of a few sort of interesting potential holiday gifts, a couple of which Julia drew my attention to. One that caught my eye is an item called an infrawave oven. And this has been produced by Black & Decker, and it takes advantage of the electromagnetic spectrum. In fact, it uses infrared light for cooking food. And this is sort of a cooking approach that's been neglected so far. But with it, they claim that you can have oven-quality taste and appearance at microwave-like speed. And that's from Black & Decker, and I think it's coming out around $200. And looks a bit like a toaster oven, frankly. Now, the other thing that caught my eye is an item from ThinkGeek, which is a website with all kinds of silly little things that you might like to play with and geek out with and purchase. And this particular item is known as Weapons of Mass Destruction at an Affordable Price. And what it is the USB missile launcher. So you can plug into your USB port. And what you plug in is sort of a foam missile launcher, and it sounds like a great way to stage an attack on your coworkers. Now, if you're looking for a gift for a bit of a hipster scientist in your family or peer group, why not check out Sonata for Violin and Turntables? This is a show that will be on Thursday, January 11th at 8 p.m. at the Chan Center, and it is a result of a collaboration between the PUSH International Performing Arts Festival and the Chan Center. And what it promises to be is a groundbreaking mix of electronica, hip-hop, and classical music with New York composer and violinist Daniel Bernard Rumain and seasoned MC producer and laptopist, I love this, DJ Scientific. So I think those are some fun potential holiday gift ideas. Now, the news that I wanted to get to was also brought to my attention by Julia, my co-host here on My Science Project. And I think you're going to like it because we're going to be talking science, but instead of me desperately trying to describe evidence to you, this one provides evidence that we can listen to. And to set that up, I'm going to play for you a tune called Bird Calls from Charles Mingus. So you're listening to Charles Mingus and a tune called Bird Calls. And the reason why this is appropriate is that we have for you a recent report on how the urban environment is altering the way birds sing. Now, this, like I said, this was brought to my attention by Julia, and I think it's just great that we can present it on the show. And if everything goes smoothly, as I really hope it will, I'll be able to play you a few examples of exactly how bird songs have changed in response to urbanization. So that's it. This is an article that was recently published by Current Biology. You can find it by going to the Current Biology website. You should have free access to that. And the researchers are Slabakum and Nbuurvisser. Not the easiest names to pronounce. But what they have done is to look at the way urban environment has altered the way birds sing. And they did this by studying a bird that's known as the great tit. So do get your giggles out, because it is a giggle-worthy name, but if you wish to be a little more highbrow about it, it's also known as the Paris Major. And for obvious reasons, ambient noises of cities can cause problems for animals, and particularly for animals that use sound to communicate. And even more problematic for birds who use songs to attract their mates. You can imagine that mating would grind to a halt if the songs could not be heard. So the ability of birds to overcome the sound hurdle is likely a key selection pressure for many bird populations. There has been research into this area previously, and it's already been demonstrated that urban nightingales adjust the loudness of their songs to increase when background noises also increase. So that's rather logical. And most urban noise comes from auto traffic. It comes from trains, low-flying airplanes, that sort of thing. And all those sources of sound produce low-frequency noise. Therefore, birds with higher pitch songs will likely have an advantage, because a higher pitch will be heard over the lower pitch or lower frequency noise. Accordingly, it's also been documented that male birds have been shown to sing at a higher pitch in urban localizations. So these researchers, Labakum and Nbuurvisser, compare the songs of the great tit in nearby urban and forest locations. And it's pretty key that they chose nearby locations, because that is a finer way to control their research. So where they chose an urban environment in Paris, in fact, they had a listen to birds very close to the Eiffel Tower in Paris, they would also choose a forest nearby in Paris. Their overall conclusions outline a trend that has been demonstrated, and that is that urban birds sang at a higher minimum frequency, so with a higher pitched tune, and also that city birds sang shorter songs, and they also use lesser pauses in their songs. Now, if you go to their website, that is the Current Biology website, and you can find that at www.current-biology.com. And on the head page, you'll find a link where you can listen to these tunes. But if luck goes my way, I'll be able to play you a few selections of bird songs in various urban and forest environments. So what I'm going to try to begin with here is an urban bird song in Paris near the Eiffel Tower. And what you'll also be able to hear in the background is some of the ambient city noise. So I'm just going to give that a try right now. So that was the great tit singing near the Eiffel Tower. A hint of romance in its voice, perhaps. A hint of urgency to get that song heard. Another example that I'll play for you is another urban location in London. And once again, the ambient sounds of traffic and the city environment have not been filtered out in this particular sample. So those are two examples of the urban song, but in order to really hear differences, it does require a very fine-tuned ear, they had to remove some of the ambient noise from the background. So I think one of the best examples that illustrates the point that these researchers wish to make with their article is what I'm about to play for you now. I'm going to play first the urban song of the Great Tit, or the Paris Major, and this happens to be a bird singing in Brussels. The ambient noise has been removed, so you need to pay attention to the pitch and also the pace of this bird song. Meanwhile, in a nearby forest, once again in a region known as the Riviere Forest, I believe also near Brussels, the same bird species was singing like this. So I think what you can really hear there are some of the strong differences. I'll play those for you once again. Here is the urban bird. And the forest bird. So I think that's a pretty fun way to have a look at some scientific evidence. And what is of note here when comparing the urban to the forest songs of the same bird species is the length of the first note, the minimum pitch of the first note, and the speed of the song. So the city bird, you can hear that there's a much shorter first note, the minimum pitch is much higher compared to the forest pairing, and the speed of the song is in a sense more urgent, and it's certainly more rapid. Now, there are a couple of possible explanations for this change, and as usual, most of these sort of biological explanations boil down to either genetic or cultural or nature or nurture. So there have been some genetic differences noticed between the city birds versus the country birds, but at the same time, you can imagine that in the city, it's very difficult for the birds perhaps communicate or teach their offspring the lower frequency songs. And so we're just going to wrap that up today. It's been fun to share a little bit of audio scientific evidence. And before Ebony joins you for Afrobeat, I'm going to leave you with a tune from the Be Good Tanyas called The Cuckoo Bird.